stared together at each other alone in space. With an effort, she glanced down at the table. "You always look so cool," she repeated. She had told him that she loved him, and Tom Buchanan saw. He was astounded. His mouth opened a little, and he looked at Gatsby and then back at Daisy, as if he had just recognized her as someone he knew a long time ago. "You resemble the advertisement of the man," she went on innocently. "You know the advertisement of the man." "All right," broke in Tom quickly. "I'm perfectly willing to go to town. Come on, we're all going to town." He got up, his eyes still flashing between Gatsby and his wife. No one moved. "Come on!" His temper cracked a little. "What's the matter, anyhow? If we're going to town, let's start." His hand, trembling with his effort at self-control, bore to his lips the last of his glass of ale. Daisy's voice got us to our feet and out onto the blazing gravel drive. "Are we just going to go?" she objected. "Like this? Aren't we going to let anyone smoke a cigarette first?" Everybody smoked all through lunch. "Oh, let's have fun," she begged him. "It's too hot to fuss." He didn't answer. "Have it your own way," she said. "Come on, Jordan." They went upstairs to get ready, while we three men stood there shuffling the hot pebbles with our feet. A silver curve of the moon hovered already in the western sky. Gatsby started to speak, changed his mind, but not before Tom wheeled and faced him expectantly. "Have you got your stables here?" asked Gatsby with an effort. "About a quarter of a mile down the road." "Oh." A pause. "I don't see the idea of going to town," broke out Tom savagely. "Women get these notions in their heads." "Shall we take anything to drink?" called Daisy from an upper window. "I'll get some whiskey," answered Tom. He went inside. Gatsby turned to me rigidly. "I can't say anything in his household, sport." "She's got an indiscreet voice," I remarked. "It's full of..." I hesitated. "Her voice is full of money," he said suddenly. That was it. I'd never understood before. It was full of money. That was the inexhaustible charm that rose and fell in it, the jingle of it, the cymbal song of it. High in a white palace, the king's daughter, the golden girl. Tom came out of the house, wrapping a quart bottle in a towel, followed by Daisy and Jordan wearing small, tight hats of metallic cloth and carrying light capes over their arms. "Shall we all go in my car?" suggested Gatsby. He felt the hot green leather of the seat. "I ought to have left it in the shade." "Is it standard shift?" demanded Tom. "Yes." "Well, you take my coupe and let me drive your car to town." The suggestion was distasteful to Gatsby. "I don't think there's much gas," he objected. "Plenty of gas," said Tom boisterously. He looked at the gauge. "And if it runs out, I can stop at a drugstore. You can buy anything at a drugstore nowadays." A pause followed this apparently pointless remark. Daisy looked at Tom, frowning, and an indefinable expression at once definitely unfamiliar and vaguely recognizable, as if I had only heard it described in words, passed over Gatsby's face. "Come on, Daisy," said Tom, pressing her with his hand towards Gatsby's car. "I'll take you in the circus wagon." He opened the door, but she moved out from the circle of his arm. "You take Nick and Jordan. We'll follow you in the coupe." She walked close to Gatsby, touching his coat with her hand. Jordan and Tom and I got into the front seat of Gatsby's car. Tom pushed the unfamiliar gears tentatively, and we shot off into the oppressive heat, leaving them out of sight behind. "Did you see that?" demanded Tom. "See what?" He looked at me keenly, realizing that Jordan and I must have known all along. "You think I'm pretty dumb, don't you?" he suggested. "Maybe I am, but I have almost a second sight sometimes that tells me what to do. Maybe you don't believe that, but science..." He paused. The immediate contingency overtook him, pulled him back from the edge of the theoretical abyss. "I've made a small investigation of this fellow," he continued. "I could have gone deeper if I'd known..."
"Do you mean you've been to a medium?" inquired Jordan humorously.
"What?"
Confused, he stared at us as we laughed.
"A medium? About Gatsby?" "About Gatsby? No, I haven't. I said I'd been making a small investigation of his past."
"And you found he was an Oxford man," said Jordan helpfully.
"An Oxford man?" He was incredulous. "Like hell he is. He wears a pink suit."
"Nevertheless, he's an Oxford man."
"Oxford, New Mexico," snorted Tom contemptuously, "or something like that."
"Listen, Tom, if you're such a snob, why did you invite him to lunch?" demanded Jordan crossly. Daisy invited him. She knew him before we were married, God knows where. We were all irritable now with the fading ale, and aware of it as we drove for a while in silence. Then, as Dr. T.J. Eckelberg's faded eyes came into sight down the road, I remembered Gatsby's caution about gasoline. "We've got enough to get us to town," said Tom. "But there's a garage right here," objected Jordan. "I don't want to get stalled in this baking heat." Tom threw on both brakes impatiently, and we slid to an abrupt, dusty stop under Wilson's sign. After a moment, the proprietor emerged from the interior of his establishment and gazed, hollow-eyed, at the car. "Let's have some gas," cried Tom roughly. "What do you think we stopped for, to admire the view?" "I'm sick," said Wilson without moving. "Been sick all day." "What's the matter?" "I'm all run down." "Well, shall I help myself?" Tom demanded. "You sounded well enough on the phone." With an effort, Wilson left the shade in support of the doorway and, breathing hard, unscrewed the cap of the tank. In the sunlight, his face was green. "I didn't mean to interrupt your lunch," he said, "but I need money pretty bad, and I was wondering what you were going to do with your old car." "How do you like this one?" inquired Tom. "I bought it last week." "It's a nice yellow one," said Wilson, as he strained at the handle. "Like to buy it?" "Big chance," Wilson smiled faintly. "No, but I could make some money on the other." "What do you want money for all of a sudden?" "I've been here too long. I want to get away. My wife and I want to go west."
"Your wife does?" exclaimed Tom, startled.
"She's been talking about it for 10 years.
He rested for a moment against the pump, shading his eyes.
"And now she's going whether she wants to or not. I'm going to get her away."
The coupe flashed by us with a flurry of dust and the flash of a waving hand.
"What do I owe you?" demanded Tom harshly.
"I just got wised up to something funny the last 2 days," remarked Wilson. "That's why I want to get away. That's why I've been bothering you about the car."
"What do I owe you?"
$1.20.
The relentless beating heat was beginning to confuse me, and I had a bad moment there before I realized that so far his suspicions hadn't alighted on Tom. He had discovered that Myrtle had some sort of life apart from him in another world, and the shock had made him physically sick. I stared at him and then at Tom, who had made a parallel discovery less than an hour before, and it occurred to me that there was no difference between men in intelligence or race so profound as the difference between the sick and the well. Wilson was so sick that he looked guilty, unforgivably guilty, as if he had just got some poor girl with child.
"I'll let you have that car," said Tom. "I'll send it over tomorrow afternoon."
That locality was always vaguely disquieting, even in the broad glare of afternoon, and now I turned my head as though I had been warned of something behind. Over the ash heaps, the giant eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg kept their vigil, but I perceived after a moment that other eyes were regarding us with peculiar intensity from less than 20 feet away. In one of the windows over the garage, the curtains had been moved aside a little, and Myrtle Wilson was peering down at the car. So engrossed was she that she had no consciousness of being observed, and one emotion after another crept into her face like objects into a slowly developing picture. Her expression was curiously familiar. It was an expression I had often seen on women's faces, but on Myrtle Wilson's face it seemed purposeless and inexplicable, until I realized that her eyes, wide with jealous terror, were fixed not on Tom, but on Jordan Baker, whom she took to be his wife. There is no confusion like the confusion of a simple mind. And as we drove away, Tom was feeling the hot whips of panic. His wife and his mistress, until an hour ago secure and inviolate, were slipping precipitately from his control. Instinct made him step on the accelerator with the double purpose of overtaking Daisy and leaving Wilson behind, and we sped along towards Astoria at 50 miles an hour until, among the spidery girders of the elevated, we came in sight of the easy-going blue coupe. "Those big movies around 50th Street are cool," suggested Jordan. "I love New York on summer afternoons when everyone's away. There's something very sensuous about it. Overripe, as if all sorts of funny fruits were going to fall into your hands."
The word sensuous had the effect of further disquieting Tom, but before he could invent a protest, the coupe came to a stop, and Daisy signaled us to draw up alongside. "Where are we going?" she cried. "How about the movies?" "It's so hot," she complained. "You go. We'll ride around and meet you after." With an effort, her wit rose faintly. "We'll meet you on some corner. I'll be the man smoking two cigarettes."
"We can't argue about it here," Tom said impatiently as a truck gave out a cursing whistle behind us. "You follow me to the south side of Central Park in front of the plaza."
Several times he turned his head and looked back for their car, and if the traffic delayed them, he slowed up until they came into sight. I think he was afraid they would dart down a side street and out of his life forever, but they didn't. And we all took the less explicable step of engaging the parlor of a suite in the Plaza Hotel. The prolonged and tumultuous argument that ended by herding us into that room eludes me, though I have a sharp physical memory that in the course of it my underwear kept climbing like a damp snake around my legs, and intermittent beads of sweat raced cool across my back. The notion originated with Daisy's suggestion that we hire 5 bathrooms and take cold baths, and then assumed a more tangible form as a place to have a mint julep. Each of us said over and over that it was a crazy idea. We all talked at once to a baffled clerk and thought or pretended to think that we were being very funny. The room was large and stifling, and though it was already 4 o'clock, opening the windows admitted only a gust of hot shrubbery from the park. Daisy went to the mirror and stood with her back to us, fixing her hair. "It's a swell suite," whispered Jordan respectfully, and everyone laughed. "Open another window," commanded Daisy without turning around. "There aren't any more. Well, we'd better telephone for an axe." "The thing to do is to forget about the heat," said Tom impatiently. "You make it 10 times worse by crabbing about it." He unrolled the bottle of whiskey from the towel and put it on the table. "Why not let her alone, old sport," remarked Gatsby. "You're the one that wanted to come to town." There was a moment of silence. A telephone book slipped from its nail and splashed to the floor, whereupon Jordan whispered, "Excuse me," but this time no one laughed. "I'll pick it up," I offered. "I've got it." Gatsby examined the parted string, muttered, "Hum," in an interested way, and tossed the book on a chair. "That's a great expression of yours, isn't it?" said Tom sharply. "What is? All this old sport business. Where'd you pick that up?"
"Now see here, Tom," said Daisy, turning around from the mirror. "If you're going to make personal remarks, I won't stay here a minute. Call up and order some ice for the mint julep."
As Tom took up the receiver, the compressed heat exploded into sound, and we were listening to the portentous chords of Mendelssohn's Wedding March from the ballroom below.
"Imagine marrying anybody in this heat," cried Jordan dismally. "Still, I was married in the middle of June," Daisy remembered. "Louisville in June. Somebody fainted. Who was it fainted, Tom?"
"Biloxi," he answered shortly.
"A man named Biloxi. Blocks Biloxi. And he made boxes. That's a fact. And he was from Biloxi, Tennessee."
"They carried him into my house," appended Jordan, "because we live just 2 doors from the church. And he stayed 3 weeks until Daddy told him he had to get out. The day after he left, Daddy died." After a moment, she added, as if she might have sounded irreverent, "There wasn't any connection."
"I used to know a Bill Biloxi from Memphis," I remarked.
"That was his cousin. I knew his whole family history before he left. He gave me an aluminum putter that I use today."
The music had died down as the ceremony began, and now a long cheer floated in at the window, followed by intermittent cries of "Yeah, yeah, yeah," and finally by a burst of jazz as the dancing began.
"We're getting old," said Daisy. "If we were young, we'd rise and dance."
"Remember Biloxi?" Jordan warned her.
"Where'd you know him, Tom?"
"Biloxi," he concentrated with an effort. "I didn't know him. He was a friend of Daisy's."
"He was not," she denied. "I'd never seen him before. He came down in the private car."
"Well, he said he knew you. He said he was raised in Louisville. Asa Bird brought him around at the last minute and asked if we had room for him."
Jordan smiled. "He was probably bumming his way home. He told me he was president of your class at Yale." Tom and I looked at each other blankly.
"Biloxi?
First place, we didn't have any president."
Gatsby's foot beat a short, restless tattoo, and Tom eyed him suddenly.
"By the way, Mr. Gatsby, I understand you're an Oxford man."
"Not exactly."
"Oh, yes, I understand you went to Oxford."
"Yes, I went there." A pause.
Then Tom's voice, incredulous and insulting. "You must have gone there about the time Biloxi went to New Haven."
Another pause. A waiter knocked and came in with crushed mint and ice, but the silence was unbroken by his thank you and the soft closing of the door. This tremendous detail was to be cleared up at last.
"I told you I went there," said Gatsby. "I heard you, but I'd like to know when."
"It was in 1919. I only stayed 5 months. That's why I can't really call myself an Oxford man."
Tom glanced around to see if we mirrored his unbelief, but we were all looking at Gatsby.
"It was an opportunity they gave to some of the officers after the armistice," he continued. "We could go to any of the universities in England or France."
I wanted to get up and slap him on the back. I had one of those renewals of complete faith in him that I'd experienced before.
Daisy rose, smiling faintly, and went to the table.
"Open the whiskey, Tom," she ordered, "and I'll make you a mint julep. Then you won't seem so stupid to yourself. Look at the mint."
"Wait a minute," snapped Tom. "I want to ask Mr. Gatsby one more question."
"Go on," Gatsby said politely.
"What kind of a row are you trying to cause in my house anyway?"
They were out in the open at last, and Gatsby was content.
"He isn't causing a row." Daisy looked desperately from one to the other. "You're causing a row. Please have a little self-control."
"Self-control?" repeated Tom incredulously. "I suppose the latest thing is to sit back and let Mr. Nobody from Nowhere make love to your wife. Well, if that's the idea, you can count me out. Nowadays people begin by sneering at family life and family institutions, and next they'll throw everything overboard and have intermarriage between black and white."
Flushed with his impassioned gibberish, he saw himself standing alone on the last barrier of civilization.
"We're all white here," murmured Jordan.
"I know I'm not very popular. I don't give big parties. I suppose you've got to make your house into a pigsty in order to have any friends in the modern world."
Angry as I was, as we all were, I was tempted to laugh whenever he opened his mouth. The transition from libertine to prig was so complete.
"I've got something to tell you, old sport," began Gatsby, but Daisy guessed at his intention.
"Please don't," she interrupted helplessly. "Please, let's all go home. Why don't we all go home?"
"That's a good idea," I got up. "Come on, Tom, nobody wants a drink. I want to know what Mr. Gatsby has to tell me."
"Your wife doesn't love you," said Gatsby. "She's never loved you. She loves me."
"You must be crazy," exclaimed Tom automatically.
Gatsby sprang to his feet, vivid with excitement.
"She never loved you, do you hear?" he cried. "She only married you because I was poor and she was tired of waiting for me. It was a terrible mistake, but in her heart she never loved anyone except me."
At this point, Jordan and I tried to go, but Tom and Gatsby insisted with competitive firmness that we remain, as though neither of them had anything to conceal and it would be a privilege to partake vicariously of their emotions.
"Sit down, Daisy." Tom's voice groped unsuccessfully for the paternal note. "What's been going on? I want to hear all about it."
"I told you what's been going on," said Gatsby. "Going on for 5 years and you didn't know." Tom turned to Daisy sharply.
"You've been seeing this fellow for 5 years.
"Not seeing," said Gatsby. "No, we couldn't meet. But both of us loved each other all that time, old sport, and you didn't know. I used to laugh sometimes," but there was no laughter in his eyes, "to think that you didn't know."
"Oh, that's all."
Tom tapped his thick fingers together like a clergyman and leaned back in his chair.
"You're crazy," he exploded. "I can't speak about what happened 5 years ago because I didn't know Daisy then, and I'll be damned if I see how you got within a mile of her unless you brought the groceries to the back door. But all the rest of that's a goddamned lie. Daisy loved me when she married me, and she loves me now."
"No," said Gatsby, shaking his head.
"She does, though. The trouble is that sometimes she gets foolish ideas in her head and doesn't know what she's doing."
He nodded sagely. "And what's more, I love Daisy, too. Once in a while I go off on a spree and make a fool of myself, but I always come back, and in my heart I love her all the time."
"You're revolting," said Daisy.
She turned to me, and her voice, dropping an octave lower, filled the room with thrilling scorn. "Do you know why we left Chicago? I'm surprised that they didn't treat you to the story of that little spree." Gatsby walked over and stood beside her.
"Daisy, that's all over now," he said earnestly. "It doesn't matter anymore. Just tell him the truth, that you never loved him, and it's all wiped out forever." She looked at him blindly.
"Why, how could I love him, possibly?"
"You never loved him." She hesitated. Her eyes fell on Jordan and me with a sort of appeal, as though she realized at last what she was doing, and as though she had never, all along, intended doing anything at all. But it was done now. It was too late. "I never loved him," she said with perceptible reluctance.
"Not at Capulani?" demanded Tom suddenly.
"No." From the ballroom beneath, muffled and suffocating chords were drifting up on hot waves of air.
"Not that day I carried you down from the punch bowl to keep your shoes dry."
There was a husky tenderness in his tone.
"Daisy, please don't."
Her voice was cold, but the rancor was gone from it. She looked at Gatsby. "There, Jay," she said. But her hand, as she tried to light a cigarette, was trembling. Suddenly she threw the cigarette and the burning match on the carpet.
"Oh, you want too much," she cried to Gatsby. "I love you now. Isn't that enough? I can't help what's past."
She began to sob helplessly.
"I did love him once, but I loved you too."
Gatsby's eyes opened and closed.
"You loved me too?" he repeated. "Even that's a lie," said Tom savagely. "She didn't know you were alive. Why, there are things between Daisy and me that you'll never know, things that neither of us can ever forget."
The words seemed to bite physically into Gatsby.
"I want to speak to Daisy alone," he insisted. "She's all excited now."
"Even alone, I can't say I never loved Tom," she admitted in a pitiful voice. "It wouldn't be true."
"Of course it wouldn't," agreed Tom.
She turned to her husband.
"As if it mattered to you," she said.
"Of course it matters. I'm going to take better care of you from now on."
"You don't understand," said Gatsby with a touch of panic. "You're not going to take care of her any more."
"I'm not?" Tom opened his eyes wide and laughed. He could afford to control himself now.
"Why's that?" "Daisy's leaving you." "Nonsense."
"I am, though," she said with visible effort.
"She's not leaving me," Tom's words suddenly leaned down over Gatsby. "Certainly not for a common swindler who'd have to steal the ring he put on her finger."
"I won't stand this," cried Daisy.
"Oh, please, let's get out."
"Who are you, anyhow?" broke out Tom.
"You're one of that bunch that hangs around with Meyer Wolfsheim. That much I happen to know. I've made a little investigation into your affairs, and I'll carry it further tomorrow."
"You can suit yourself about that, old sport," said Gatsby steadily.
"I found out what your drug stores were." He turned to us and spoke rapidly. "He and this Wolfsheim bought up a lot of side street drug stores here and in Chicago and sold grain alcohol over the counter. That's one of his little stunts. I picked him for a bootlegger the first time I saw him, and I wasn't far wrong."
"What about it?" said Gatsby politely. "I guess your friend Walter Chase wasn't too proud to come in on it."
"And you left him in the lurch, didn't you? You let him go to jail for a month over in New Jersey. God, you ought to hear Walter on the subject of you."
"He came to us dead broke. He was very glad to pick up some money, old sport."
"Don't you call me old sport," cried Tom.
Gatsby said nothing.
"Walter could have you up on the betting laws, too, but Wolfsheim scared him into shutting his mouth."
That unfamiliar yet recognizable look was back again in Gatsby's face.
"That drugstore business was just small change," continued Tom slowly. "But you've got something on now that Walter's afraid to tell me about."
I glanced at Daisy, who was staring, terrified, between Gatsby and her husband, and at Jordan, who had begun to balance an invisible but absorbing object on the tip of her chin. Then I turned back to Gatsby, and was startled at his expression. He looked, and this is said in all contempt for the babbled slander of his garden, as if he had killed a man. For a moment the set of his face could be described in just that fantastic way. It passed, and he began to talk excitedly to Daisy, denying everything, defending his name against accusations that had not been made. But with every word she was drawing further and further into herself, so he gave that up, and only the dead dream fought on as the afternoon slipped away, trying to touch what was no longer tangible, struggling unhappily, undespairingly toward that lost voice across the room. The voice begged again to go. "Please, Tom, I can't stand this anymore." Her frightened eyes told that whatever intentions, whatever courage she had had, were definitely gone.
"You two start on home, Daisy," said Tom, "in Mr. Gatsby's car."
She looked at Tom, alarmed now, but he insisted with magnanimous scorn. "Go on, he won't annoy you. I think he realizes that his presumptuous little flirtation is over." They were gone, without a word, snapped out, made accidental, isolated, like ghosts, even from our pity. After a moment, Tom got up and began wrapping the unopened bottle of whiskey in the towel.
"Want any of this stuff, Jordan? Nick?"
I didn't answer.
"Nick?"
he asked again.
"What?"
"Want any?"
No, I just remember that today's my birthday. I was 30. Before me stretched the portentous, menacing road of a new decade. It was 7 o'clock when we got into the coupe with him and started for Long Island. Tom talked incessantly, exulting and laughing, but his voice was as remote from Jordan and me as the foreign clamor on the sidewalk or the tumult of the elevated overhead. Human sympathy has its limits, and we were content to let all their tragic arguments fade with the city lights behind. 30. The promise of a decade of loneliness, a thinning list of single men to know, a thinning briefcase of enthusiasm, thinning hair. But there was Jordan beside me, who, unlike Daisy, was too wise ever to carry well-forgotten dreams from age to age. As we passed over the dark bridge, her wan face fell lazily against my coat's shoulder, and the formidable stroke of 30 died away with the reassuring pressure of her hand. So we drove on toward death through the cooling twilight. The young Greek, Michaelis, who ran the coffee joint beside the ash heaps, was the principal witness at the inquest. He had slept through the heat until after 5, when he strolled over to the garage and found George Wilson sick in his office. Really sick, pale as his own pale hair, and shaking all over. Michaelis advised him to go to bed, but Wilson refused, saying that he'd miss a lot of business if he did. While his neighbor was trying to persuade him, a violent racket broke out overhead. "I've got my wife locked in up there," explained Wilson calmly. "She's going to stay there till the day after tomorrow, and then we're going to move away." Michaelis was astonished. They had been neighbors for 4 years, and Wilson had never seemed faintly capable of such a statement. Generally, he was one of these worn-out men. When he wasn't working, he sat on a chair in the doorway and stared at the people in the cars that passed along the road. When anyone spoke to him, he invariably laughed in an agreeable, colorless way. He was his wife's man and not his own. So, naturally, Michaelis tried to find out what had happened, but Wilson wouldn't say a word. Instead, he began to throw curious, suspicious glances at his visitor and ask him what he'd been doing at certain times on certain days. Just as the latter was getting uneasy, some workmen came past the door, bound for his restaurant, and Michaelis took the opportunity to get away, intending to come back later. But he didn't. He supposed he forgot to, that's all. When he came outside again, a little after 7, he was reminded of the conversation because he heard Mrs. Wilson's voice, loud and scolding, downstairs in the garage. "Beat me," he heard her cry. "Throw me down and beat me, you dirty little coward." A moment later, she rushed out into the dusk, waving her hands and shouting. Before he could move from his door, the business was over. The death car, as the newspapers called it, didn't stop. It came out of the gathering darkness, wavered tragically for a moment, and then disappeared around the next bend. Michaelis wasn't even sure of its color. He told the first policeman that it was light green. The other car, the one going toward New York, came to rest 100 yards beyond, and its driver hurried back to where Myrtle Wilson, her life violently extinguished, knelt in the road and mingled her thick, dark blood with the dust. Michaelis and this man reached her first, but when they had torn open her shirtwaist, still damp with perspiration, they saw that her left breast was swinging loose like a flap, and there was no need to listen for the heart beneath. The mouth was wide open and ripped at the corners, as though she had choked a little in giving up the tremendous vitality she had stored so long.
This ends Disc 3. The Great Gatsby, Disc 4.
We saw the 3 or 4 automobiles in the crowd when we were still some distance away. "Wreck," said Tom. "That's good. Wilson will have a little business at last." He slowed down, but still without any intention of stopping, until, as we came nearer, the hushed, intent faces of the people at the garage door made him automatically put on the brakes. "We'll take a look," he said doubtfully, "just a look." I became aware now of a hollow, wailing sound which issued incessantly from the garage, a sound which, as we got out of the coupe and walked toward the door, resolved itself into the words, "Oh, my God," uttered over and over in a gasping moan. There's some bad trouble here, said Tom excitedly. He reached up on tiptoes and peered over a circle of heads into the garage, which was lit only by a yellow light in a swinging wire basket overhead. Then he made a harsh sound in his throat and, with a violent thrusting movement of his powerful arms, pushed his way through. The circle closed up again with a running murmur of expostulation. It was a minute before I could see anything at all. Then new arrivals deranged the line, and Jordan and I were pushed suddenly inside. Myrtle Wilson's body wrapped in a blanket and then in another blanket, as though she suffered from a chill in the hot night, lay on a work table by the wall, and Tom, with his back to us, was bending over it motionless. Next to him stood a motorcycle policeman taking down names with much sweat and correction in a little book. At first I couldn't find the source of the high, groaning words that echoed clamorously through the bare garage. Then I saw Wilson standing on the raised threshold of his office, swaying back and forth and holding to the doorposts with both hands. Some man was talking to him in a low voice and attempting from time to time to lay a hand on his shoulder, but Wilson neither heard nor saw. His eyes would drop slowly from the swinging light to the laden table by the wall, and then jerk back to the light again, and he gave out incessantly his high, horrible call. "Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!" Presently Tom lifted his head with a jerk, and after staring around the garage with glazed eyes, addressed a mumbled, incoherent remark to the policeman. "M-A-V," the policeman was saying. "Oh, no, R," corrected the man. "M-A-V-R-O." "Listen to me," muttered Tom fiercely. "R," said the policeman. "O-G-G." He looked up as Tom's broad hand fell sharply on his shoulder. "What do you want, fella?" "What happened? That's what I want to know." "Auto hit her. Instantly killed."
"Instantly killed," repeated Tom, staring.
"She ran out in the road. Son of a bitch didn't even stop his car."
"There was two cars," said Michaelis.
"One coming, one going, see?"
"Going where?" asked the policeman keenly.
"One going each way."
"Well, she—" His hand rose toward the blankets, but stopped halfway and fell to his side.
"She ran out there, and the one coming from New York knocked right into her, going 30 or 40 miles an hour.
"What's the name of this place here?" demanded the officer.
"Hasn't got any name."
A pale, well-dressed Negro stepped near.
"It was a yellow car," he said. "Big yellow car, new."
"See the accident?" asked the policeman.
"No, but the car passed me down the road, going faster than 40, going 50, 60.
"Come here and let's have your name. Look out now, I want to get his name." Some words of this conversation must have reached Wilson, swaying in the office door, for suddenly a new theme found voice among his gasping cries.
"You don't have to tell me what kind of car it was. I know what kind of car it was."
Watching Tom, I saw the wad of muscle back of his shoulder tighten under his coat. He walked quickly over to Wilson and, standing in front of him, seized him firmly by the upper arms.
"You've got to pull yourself together," he said with soothing gruffness.
Wilson's eyes fell upon Tom. He started up on his tiptoes and then would have collapsed to his knees had not Tom held him upright.
"Listen," said Tom, shaking him a little. "I just got here a minute ago from New York. I was bringing you that coupe we've been talking about. That yellow car I was driving this afternoon wasn't mine, do you hear? I haven't seen it all afternoon."
Only the Negro and I were near enough to hear what he said, but the policeman caught something in the tone and looked over with truculent eyes.
"What's all that?" he demanded.
"I'm a friend of his." Tom turned his head, but kept his hands firm on Wilson's body. "He says he knows the car that did it. It was a yellow car." Some dim impulse moved the policeman to look suspiciously at Tom.
"And what color's your car?"
"It's a blue car, a coupe."
"We've come straight from New York," I said.
Someone who had been driving a little behind us confirmed this, and the policeman turned away.
"Now, if you'll let me have that name again correct," picking up Wilson like a doll, Tom carried him into the office, set him down in a chair, and came back. "If somebody'll come here and sit with him," he snapped authoritatively.
He watched while the two men standing closest glanced at each other and went unwillingly into the room. Then Tom shut the door on them and came down the single step, his eyes avoiding the table. As he passed close to me, he whispered, "Let's get out." Self-consciously, with his authoritative arms breaking the way, we pushed through the still-gathering crowd, passing a hurried doctor, case in hand, who had been sent for in wild hope half an hour ago.
Tom drove slowly until we were beyond the bend. Then his foot came down hard, and the coupe raced along through the night. In a little while I heard a low, husky sob and saw that the tears were overflowing down his face. "The goddamn coward," he whimpered. "He didn't even stop his car." The Buchanan's house floated suddenly toward us through the dark, rustling trees. Tom stopped beside the porch and looked up at the second floor, where two windows bloomed with light among the vines. "Daisy's home," he said. As we got out of the car, he glanced at me and frowned slightly. "I ought to have dropped you in West Egg, Nick. There's nothing we can do tonight." A change had come over him, and he spoke gravely and with decision. As we walked across the moonlight gravel to the porch, he disposed of the situation in a few brisk phrases. "I'll telephone for a taxi to take you home, and while you're waiting, you and Jordan better go in the kitchen and have them get you some supper if you want any." He opened the door. "Come in." "No, thanks, but I'd be glad if you'd order me the taxi. I'll wait outside." Jordan put her hand on my arm. "Won't you come in, Nick?" "No, thanks. I was feeling a little sick, and I wanted to be alone." But Jordan lingered for a moment more. "It's only 9:30, she said. "I'd be damned if I go in. I'd had enough of all of them for one day, and suddenly that included Jordan, too. She must have seen something of this in my expression, for she turned abruptly away and ran up the porch steps into the house. I sat down for a few minutes with my head in my hands, until I heard the phone taken up inside and the butler's voice calling a taxi. Then I walked slowly down the drive away from the house, intending to wait by the gate. I hadn't gone 20 yards when I heard my name, and Gatsby stepped from between two bushes into the path. I must have felt pretty weird by that time, because I could think of nothing except the luminosity of his pink suit under the moon. "What are you doing?" I inquired. "Just standing here, old sport." Somehow that seemed a despicable occupation. For all I knew, he was going to rob the house in a moment. I wouldn't have been surprised to see sinister faces, the faces of Wolfsheim's people behind him in the dark shrubbery. "Did you see any trouble on the road?" he asked after a minute. "Yes," he hesitated. "Was she killed?" "Yes." "I thought so. I told Daisy I thought so. It's better that the shock should all come at once. She stood it pretty well." He spoke as if Daisy's reaction was the only thing that mattered. "I got to West Egg by a side road," he went on. "I left the car in my garage. I don't think anybody saw us, but of course I can't be sure." I disliked him so much by this time that I didn't find it necessary to tell him he was wrong. "Who was the woman?" he inquired. "Her name was Wilson. Her husband owns the garage. How the devil did it happen?" "Well, I tried to swing the wheel..." He broke off, and suddenly I guessed at the truth. "Was Daisy driving?" "Yes," he said after a moment. "But of course I'll say I was. You see, when we left New York, she was very nervous, and she thought it would steady her to drive. And this woman rushed out at us just as we were passing a car coming the other way. It all happened in a minute. But it seemed to me that she wanted to speak to us, thought we were somebody she knew. Well, first Daisy turned away from the woman toward the other car, and then she lost her nerve and turned back. The second my hand reached the wheel, I felt the shock. It must have killed her instantly." It ripped her open. "Don't tell me, old sport," he winced. "Anyhow, Daisy stepped on it. I tried to make her stop, but she couldn't. So I pulled on the emergency brake. Then she fell over into my lap, and I drove on." "She'll be all right tomorrow," he said presently. "I'm just going to wait here and see if he tries to bother her about that unpleasantness this afternoon. She's locked herself into her room, and if he tries any brutality, she's going to turn the light out and on again." "He won't touch her," I said. "He's not thinking about her." "I don't trust him, old sport." "How long are you going to wait?" "All night, if necessary. Anyhow, till they all go to bed." A new point of view occurred to me. Suppose Tom found out that Daisy had been driving. He might think he saw a connection in it. He might think anything. I looked at the house. There were 2 or 3 bright windows downstairs and the pink glow from Daisy's room on the second floor. "You wait here," I said. "I'll see if there's any sign of a commotion." I walked back along the border of the lawn, traversed the gravel softly, and tiptoed up the veranda steps. The drawing room curtains were open, and I saw that the room was empty. Crossing the porch where we had dined that June, 3 months before, I came to a small rectangle of light, which I guessed was the pantry window. The blind was drawn, but I found a rift at the sill. Daisy and Tom were sitting opposite each other at the kitchen table with a plate of cold fried chicken between them and two bottles of ale. He was talking intently across the table at her, and in his earnestness his hand had fallen upon and covered her own. Once in a while she looked up at him and nodded in agreement. They weren't happy, and neither of them had touched the chicken or the ale, and yet they weren't unhappy either. There was an unmistakable air of natural intimacy about the picture, and anybody would have said that they were conspiring together. As I tiptoed from the porch, I heard my taxi feeling its way along the dark road toward the house. Gatsby was waiting where I had left him in the drive. "Is it all quiet up there?" he asked anxiously. "Yes, it's all quiet." I hesitated. "You'd better come home and get some sleep." He shook his head. "I want to wait here until Daisy goes to bed. Good night, old sport." He put his hands in his coat pockets and turned back eagerly to his scrutiny of the house, as though my presence marred the sacredness of the vigil. So I walked away and left him standing there in the moonlight, watching over nothing. Chapter 8. I couldn't sleep all night. A foghorn was groaning incessantly on the sound, and I tossed half-sick between grotesque reality and savage, frightening dreams. Toward dawn, I heard a taxi go up Gatsby's drive, and immediately I jumped out of bed and began to dress. I felt that I had something to tell him, something to warn him about, and morning would be too late. Crossing his lawn, I saw that his front door was still open, and he was leaning against a table in the hall, heavy with dejection or sleep. "Nothing happened," he said wanly. I waited. At about 4 o'clock she came to the window and stood there for a minute, and then turned out the light. His house had never seemed so enormous to me as it did that night, when we hunted through the great rooms for cigarettes. We pushed aside curtains that were like pavilions and felt over innumerable feet of dark wall for electric light switches. Once I tumbled with a sort of splash upon the keys of a ghostly piano. There was an inexplicable amount of dust everywhere, and the rooms were musty, as though they hadn't been aired for many days. I found the humidor on an unfamiliar table with two stale, dry cigarettes inside. Throwing open the French windows of the drawing room, we sat, smoking, out into the darkness. "You ought to go away," I said. "It's pretty certain they'll trace your car." "Go away now, old sport." "Go to Atlantic City for a week, or up to Montreal." He wouldn't consider it. He couldn't possibly leave Daisy until he knew what she was going to do. He was clutching at some last hope, and I couldn't bear to shake him free. It was this night that he told me the strange story of his youth with Dan Cody, told it to me because J. Gatsby had broken up like glass against Tom's hard malice, and the long, secret extravaganza was played out. I think that he would have acknowledged anything now, without reserve, but he wanted to talk about Daisy. She was the first nice girl he had ever known. In various unrevealed capacities he had come in contact with such people, but always with indiscernible barbed wire between. He found her excitingly desirable. He went to her house, at first with other officers from Camp Taylor, then alone. It amazed him. He had never been in such a beautiful house before, but what gave it an air of breathless intensity was that Daisy lived there. It was as casual a thing to her as his tent out at camp was to him. There was a ripe mystery about it, a hint of bedrooms upstairs more beautiful and cool than other bedrooms, of gay and radiant activities taking place through its corridors, and of romances that were not musty and laid away already in lavender, but fresh and breathing and redolent of this year's shining motor cars and of dances whose flowers were scarcely withered. It excited him, too, that many men had already loved Daisy. It increased her value in his eyes. He felt their presence all about the house, pervading the air with the shades and echoes of still vibrant emotions. But he knew that he was in Daisy's house by a colossal accident. However glorious might be his future as J. Gatsby, he was at present a penniless young man without a past, and at any moment the invisible cloak of his uniform might slip from his shoulders. So he made the most of his time. He took what he could get, ravenously and unscrupulously. Eventually he took Daisy one still October night, took her because he had no real right to touch her hand. He might have despised himself, for he had certainly taken her under false pretenses. I don't mean that he had traded on his phantom millions, but he had deliberately given Daisy a sense of security. He let her believe that he was a person from much the same stratum as herself, that he was fully able to take care of her. As a matter of fact, he had no such facilities. He had no comfortable family standing behind him, and he was liable at the whim of an impersonal government to be blown anywhere about the world. But he didn't despise himself, and it didn't turn out as he had imagined. He had intended, probably, to take what he could and go, but now he found that he had committed himself to the following of a grail. He knew that Daisy was extraordinary, but he didn't realize just how extraordinary a nice girl could be. She vanished into her rich house, into her rich, full life, leaving Gatsby nothing. He felt married to her, that was all. When they met again 2 days later, it was Gatsby who was breathless, who was somehow betrayed. Her porch was bright with the bought luxury of starshine. The wicker of the settee squeaked fashionably as she turned toward him, and he kissed her curious and lovely mouth. She had caught a cold, and it made her voice huskier and more charming than ever, and Gatsby was overwhelmingly aware of the youth and mystery that wealth imprisons and preserves, of the freshness of many clothes, and of Daisy gleaming like silver, safe and proud above the hot struggles of the poor. "I can't describe to you how surprised I was to find out I loved her, old sport. I even hoped for a while that she'd throw me over, but she didn't, because she was in love with me, too. She thought I knew a lot, because I knew different things from her. Well, there I was, way off my ambitions, getting deeper in love every minute, and all of a sudden I didn't care. What was the use of doing great things if I could have a better time telling her what I was going to do?" On the last afternoon before he went abroad, he sat with Daisy in his arms for a long, silent time. It was a cold fall day, with fire in the room, and her cheeks flushed. Now and then she moved, and he changed his arm a little, and once he kissed her dark, shining hair. The afternoon had made them tranquil for a while, as if to give them a deep memory for the long parting the next day promised. They had never been closer in their month of love, nor communicated more profoundly one with another than when she brushed silent lips against his coat shoulder, or when he touched the end of her fingers gently as though she were asleep. He did extraordinarily well in the war. He was a captain before he went to the front, and following the Argonne battles he got his majority and the command of the divisional machine guns. After the armistice he tried frantically to get home, but some complication or misunderstanding sent him to Oxford instead. He was worried now. There was a quality of nervous despair in Daisy's letters. She didn't see why he couldn't come. She was feeling the pressure of the world outside, and she wanted to see him and feel his presence beside her and be reassured that she was doing the right thing after all. For Daisy was young, and her artificial world was redolent of orchids and pleasant, cheerful snobbery and orchestras which set the rhythm of the year, summing up the sadness and suggestiveness of life in new tunes. All night the saxophones wailed the hopeless comment of the Beale Street Blues, while 100 pairs of golden and silver slippers shuffled the shining dust. At the grey tea hour there were always rooms that throbbed incessantly with this low, sweet fever, while fresh faces drifted here and there like rose petals blown by the sad horns around the floor. Through this twilight universe, Daisy began to move again with the season. Suddenly she was again keeping half a dozen dates a day with half a dozen men, and drowsing asleep at dawn with the beads and chiffon of an evening dress tangled among dying orchids on the floor beside her bed. And all the time something within her was crying for a decision. She wanted her life shaped now, immediately, and the decision must be made by some force of love, of money, of unquestionable practicality that was close at hand. That force took shape in the middle of spring with the arrival of Tom Buchanan. There was a wholesome bulkiness about his person and his position, and Daisy was flattered. Doubtless there was a certain struggle and a certain relief. The letter reached Gatsby while he was still at Oxford. It was dawn now on Long Island, and we went about opening the rest of the windows downstairs, filling the house with grey-turning, gold-turning light. The shadow of a tree fell abruptly across the dew, and ghostly birds began to sing among the blue leaves. There was a slow, pleasant movement in the air, scarcely a wind, promising a cool, lovely day. "I don't think she ever loved him," Gatsby turned around from a window and looked at me challengingly. "You must remember, old sport, she was very excited this afternoon. He told her those things in a way that frightened her, that made it look as if I was some kind of cheap sharper, and the result was she hardly knew what she was saying." He sat down gloomily. "Of course she might have loved him for just a minute when they were first married, and loved me more even then, do you see?" Suddenly he came out with a curious remark. "In any case," he said, "it was just personal." And what could you make of that, except to suspect some intensity in his conception of the affair that couldn't be measured? He came back from France when Tom and Daisy were still on their wedding trip, and made a miserable but irresistible journey to Louisville on the last of his army pay. He stayed there a week, walking the streets where their footsteps had clicked together through the November night, and revisiting the out-of-the-way places to which they had driven in her white car. Just as Daisy's house had always seemed to him more mysterious and gay than other houses, so his idea of the city itself, even though she was gone from it, was pervaded with a melancholy beauty. He left feeling that if he had searched harder he might have found her, that he was leaving her behind. The day coach, he was penniless now, was hot. He went out to the open vestibule and sat down on a folding chair, and the station slid away and the backs of unfamiliar buildings moved by. Then out into the spring fields, where a yellow trolley raced them for a minute, with people in it who might once have seen the pale magic of her face along the casual street. The track curved, and now it was going away from the sun, which, as it sank lower, seemed to spread itself in benediction over the vanishing city where she had drawn her breath. He stretched out his hand desperately, as if to snatch only a wisp of air, to save a fragment of the spot that she had made lovely for him. But it was all going by too fast now for his blurred eyes, and he knew that he had lost that part of it, the freshest and the best forever. It was 9 o'clock when we finished breakfast and went out on the porch. The night had made a sharp difference in the weather, and there was an autumn flavor in the air. The gardener, the last one of Gatsby's former servants, came to the foot of the steps. "I'm going to drain the pool today, Mr. Gatsby. Leaves will start falling pretty soon, and then there's always trouble with the pipes." "Don't do it today," Gatsby answered. He turned to me apologetically. "You know, old sport, I've never used that pool all summer." I looked at my watch and stood up. 12 minutes to my train. I didn't want to go to the city. I wasn't worth a decent stroke of work. But it was more than that. I didn't want to leave Gatsby. I missed that train, and then another before I could get myself away. "I'll call you up," I said finally. "Do, old sport. I'll call you about noon." We walked slowly down the steps. "I suppose Daisy'll call, too." He looked at me anxiously, as if he hoped I'd corroborate this. "I suppose so." "Well, goodbye." We shook hands, and I started away. Just before I reached the hedge, I remembered something and turned around. "They're a rotten crowd," I shouted across the lawn. "You're worth the whole damn bunch put together." I've always been glad I said that. It was the only compliment I ever gave him, because I disapproved of him from beginning to end. First he nodded politely, and then his face broke into that radiant and understanding smile, as if we'd been in ecstatic cahoots on that fact all the time. His gorgeous pink rag of a suit made a bright spot of color against the white steps, and I thought of the night when I first came to his ancestral home 3 months before. The lawn and drive had been crowded with the faces of those who guessed at his corruption, and he had stood on those steps concealing his incorruptible dream as he waved them goodbye. I thanked him for his hospitality. We were always thanking him for that, I and the others. "Goodbye," I called. "I enjoyed breakfast, Gatsby." Up in the city, I tried for a while to list the quotations on an interminable amount of stock. Then I fell asleep in my swivel chair. Just before noon, the phone woke me, and I started up with sweat breaking out on my forehead. It was Jordan Baker. She often called me up at this hour, because the uncertainty of her own movements between hotels and clubs and private houses made her hard to find in any other way. Usually her voice came over the wire as something fresh and cool, as if a divot from the green golf links had come sailing in at the office window, but this morning it seemed harsh and dry. "I've left Daisy's house," she said. "I'm at Hempstead, and I'm going down to Southampton this afternoon." Probably it had been tactful to leave Daisy's house, but the act annoyed me, and her next remark made me rigid. "You weren't so nice to me last night." "How could it have mattered then?" Silence for a moment. Then, "However, I want to see you. I want to see you, too. Suppose I don't go to Southampton and come into town this afternoon." "No, I don't think this afternoon." "Very well. It's impossible this afternoon. Various..." We talked like that for a while, and then abruptly we weren't talking any longer. I don't know which of us hung up with a sharp click, but I know I didn't care. I couldn't have talked to her across a tea table that day if I never talked to her again in this world. I called Gatsby's house a few minutes later, but the line was busy. I tried four times. Finally, an exasperated central told me the wire was being kept open for long distance from Detroit. Taking out my timetable, I drew a small circle around the 3:50 train. Then I leaned back in my chair and tried to think. It was just noon. When I passed the ash heaps on the train that morning, I had crossed deliberately to the other side of the car. I supposed there'd be a curious crowd around there all day, with little boys searching for dark spots in the dust and some garrulous man telling over and over what had happened, until it became less and less real even to him, and he could tell it no longer, and Myrtle Wilson's tragic achievement was forgotten. Now I want to go back a little and tell what happened at the garage after we left there the night before. They had difficulty in locating the sister, Catherine. She must have broken her rule against drinking that night, for when she arrived she was stupid with liquor, and unable to understand that the ambulance had already gone to Flushing. When they convinced her of this, she immediately fainted, as if that was the intolerable part of the affair. Someone, kind or curious, took her in his car and drove her in the wake of her sister's body. Until long after midnight, a changing crowd lapped up against the front of the garage, while George Wilson rocked himself back and forth on the couch inside. For a while the door of the office was open, and everyone who came into the garage glanced irresistibly through it. Finally someone said it was a shame and closed the door. Michaelis and several other men were with him, first four or five men, later two or three men. Still later Michaelis had to ask the last stranger to wait there 15 minutes longer while he went back to his own place and made a pot of coffee. After that, he stayed there alone with Wilson until dawn. About 3 o'clock, the quality of Wilson's incoherent muttering changed. He grew quieter and began to talk about the yellow car. He announced that he had a way of finding out whom the yellow car belonged to, and then he blurted out that a couple of months ago his wife had come from the city with her face bruised and her nose swollen. But when he heard himself say this, he flinched and began to cry, "Oh, my God!" again in his groaning voice. Michaelis made a clumsy attempt to distract him. "How long have you been married, George? Come on there, try and sit still a minute and answer my question. How long have you been married?"
12 years.
"Ever had any children?" "Come on, George, sit still. I asked you a question. Did you ever have any children?"
The hard brown beetles kept thudding against the dull light. And whenever Michaelis heard a car go tearing along the road outside, it sounded to him like the car that hadn't stopped a few hours before. He didn't like to go into the garage because the workbench was stained where the body had been lying, so he moved uncomfortably around the office. He knew every object in it before morning, and from time to time sat down beside Wilson, trying to keep him more quiet.
"Have you got a church you go to sometimes, George? Maybe even if you haven't been there for a long time? Maybe I could call up the church and get a priest to come over and he could talk to you, see?"
"Don't belong to any."
"You ought to have a church, George, for times like this. You must have gone to church once. Didn't you get married in a church? Listen, George, listen to me. Didn't you get married in a church?"
"That was a long time ago."
The effort of answering broke the rhythm of his rocking. For a moment he was silent. Then the same half-knowing, half-bewildered look came back into his faded eyes.
"Look in the drawer there," he said, pointing at the desk.
"Which drawer?"
"That drawer, that one."
Michaelis opened the drawer nearest his hand. There was nothing in it but a small, expensive dog leash, made of leather and braided silver,
It was apparently new.
This? He inquired, holding it up.
Wilson stared and nodded. I found it yesterday afternoon. She tried to tell me about it, but I knew it was something funny.
You mean your wife bought it?
She had it wrapped in tissue paper on her bureau. Michaelis didn't see anything odd in that, and he gave Wilson a dozen reasons why his wife might have bought the dog leash. But conceivably Wilson had heard